A few days ago, I got one of those calls in the early evening, and it was from a number that I didn't recognize. And I don't know whether you have had a recent experience about that, but I ended up taking it. And well, sometimes when I answer those calls, I don't even give my name, but I can't remember whether I did or not on this particular case. And anyway, it turned out to be someone wanting to poll me and interview me and ask me a whole bunch of questions about, I don't know, about government policy or something like that. I have actually engaged in those before, but on this particular occasion, I politely declined. And because, apart from anything else, I just couldn't face 10 to 15 minutes of having to answer questions. Because I think sometimes we have a love-hate relationship with questions, don't we? Sometimes we love them and sometimes we hate them. And it goes, all the way back to when we're really, really young. Some of the first words that children learn to speak are question words. Why is a question that children ask incessantly and incessantly. And sometimes I think parents, sort of, put it all on the kids. The kids are always asking why. But if we stopped for a moment and stood back, we would find that probably we are also just as much asking questions of them. What's that over there? What do you want? Where are you going? And there's no surprise that our children then start mirroring back to us and asking questions themselves of us. And it's actually a really important part to their process, isn't it? And but when we go through life and when we get older, then there's sometimes when we really like questions, we like people finding out about us, and other times maybe we're tired or maybe people are asking us sensitive questions and we're just over them. The last thing we want to do is we want to face another question. We have these love-hate relationship with questions. Why, David, are you talking about questions this morning? Well, that's a good question to ask, isn't it? It's because questions are so central, aren't they, to our life. When we stop and think about it, how many times we or someone else ask who, why, what, when, how? Even when you're watching TV, the crime thrill, the crime show is asking essentially the question, who done it? And they sort of drag it out over an hour to get you to get to the end of the show and watching a whole lot of ads along the way, of course, to find out the answer to the question, who done it? So even in our entertainment, the questions are there. They may not be explicit, but they are implicit. And our world and our interactions revolve around questions of one way or another. And then we come to the whole area of religion, don't we? Because religions are offering answers to the deep questions of life. But sometimes we think religion is, once they've provided the answers, is about shutting down further questions. And maybe you've even felt like that in churches. You have questions about God and about life, about the Bible, about Jesus, about what it means to be a Christian or whatever else, and you felt like the questions have been shut down. Oh, have you ever thought about Jesus' approach to questions? Have you ever observed in the Gospels the way Jesus responded to the questions, the way Jesus asked questions? Because this is vitally important. Because if we're followers of Jesus, then we need to understand, because Jesus is the same yesterday and today and forever. And his approach to questions back then is probably going to be similar to God's approach to questions to us right now. And especially if we understand ourselves as disciples of Jesus, or students of Jesus, in other terms, then questions are going to be central. Just imagine a classroom where there were no questions, either asked by the teacher or asked by the students. Imagine an apprenticeship where there was no questions that flowed between the master and the apprentice. Imagine any sporting club where there was no questions that flowed between the coach and the players. Imagine virtually any field of learning formal or informal, where there were no questions. And so today I want to spend some time deliberately looking at some of the ways that Jesus used questions with the early disciples, the first disciples, so that we can begin to think, be aware of this Jesus' approach to questions and the sort of questions Jesus might be asking, and then the sort of questions that we in turn might be, it might be good for us to ask of Jesus. And there's the passage in Mark chapter 8, where in the first eight chapters of Mark, Jesus has launched his public ministry. He's invited people to follow him. He's gone around performing amazing miracles and healing people and walking on the water and feeding 5,000 and feeding 4,000. And then the Pharisees come at the end of all that and they're asking him for a sign. And Jesus says he won't give it to them. And then he gets in a boat with his disciples. And then I'm going to read in Mark chapter 8 from verse 14. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. Be careful, Jesus warned them. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. They discussed with one another and said, it is because we have no bread. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have no eyes but fail to see and ears and fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke five loaves for 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 12, they replied. And when I broke the seven loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? They answered, seven. He said to them, do you still not understand? And in many ways, it's like they've been going around with Jesus and they've even been participating in the miracles and doing some of themselves. And then Jesus asks these back and forth questions and it's almost like, okay, you guys need to go into remedial class. You haven't quite got it yet. And then there's this passage section in Mark, which I think is we could almost describe it as a discipleship manual. Many of you will be aware of there's the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5 through to 7, and that's a sort of defined section. It's a well-known section. Well, I think the next bit here in Mark, from Mark chapter 8, verse 22 to the end of chapter 10, is like a discipleship manual. So Jesus has been taking his disciples around with him on mission and have been engaging in it. And then this is where Mark gathers together some of the important things about what it means to actually be in that sort of teaching, engaging, learning, discipling role with Jesus. And it's very interesting. The Gospel of Mark frames it around the only two records of a blind person being healed. Because Jesus said, he has just said essentially in an understanding sense, don't you see? And then he goes in Mark 8:22, they came to Bethsaida and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spat on the man's eyes, he put his hands on him. Jesus asked, do you see anything? He looked up and said, I see people. They look like trees walking around. Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened and his sight was restored and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home saying, don't even go into the village. And this is the only sort of two-stage healing miracle that is recorded anywhere in the Gospels. And I think it's a metaphor that, I'm not saying it didn't happen. What I'm saying is that it's also points to the spiritual condition or the learning condition of the disciples. They'd seen something about Jesus, but they weren't seeing clearly yet. And at the end of Mark chapter 10, there's a story of blind Bartimaeus. And Jesus heals the blind man. And then it says in verse 52, go, said Jesus, your faith has healed you. Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. And these two stories of healing of blind people frame a section that I think has many, many insights about the discipleship process, the process of learning to become like Jesus, the process of learning how to live my life as Jesus would live my life if he were me. It's not so much that all of the content or all of the topics are there, but many topics are referred to there and many processes are also summarized there as well. And one of the features of this section is the way Jesus asks questions. You know, many people sort of say, almost in an offhanded sort of way, well, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask God dot, dot, dot. A long list of confusing questions or things that they have. But not many of us think, maybe God is asking questions of me right now. Now, sometimes there's the sort of the cliched view of you get to the pearly gates when you die and St. Peter's there and asks you a bunch of questions. If you answer them right, then you get into heaven. Well, that's not the way it works. And again, that's always putting the questions off to the future rather than thinking about, well, what are the sort of questions that God, what are the sort of questions that Jesus might be asking you and me now? And this section, I think, highlights some of those. It goes on to say, after that first story of the healing of the blind man, Jesus and his disciples went to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, who do people say that I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked, who do you say that I am? Peter answered, you are the Messiah. And what we see here is Jesus is asking questions to try and draw things out of the disciples. Now, he's actually starting at a really critical place, which is the disciples' understanding of who Jesus was. And from the answer, it's clear that Peter had understood that Jesus was the Messiah. But in the teaching that goes on, it becomes clear that they had a different concept of what the Messiah was and who the Messiah was and what the Messiah would do than what Jesus understood his actual role of Messiahship to be. And so they were people that like saw people, but they were like trees. They were half healed from their blindness, but they weren't fully healed from their blindness. But Jesus was asking these questions to help them draw out of them what they understood. And that's the sort of question that I think Jesus asks us today. Who do people say that I am? And people have different answers to that. He's a great teacher, or he's a prophet, or whatever. And then I think God asks of us, well, who do you say that Jesus is? You know, they're not, Jesus, I'm just going to bring up some of the questions that I have organized from earlier. So bear with me. Because Jesus then, further on in chapter 9, they had been up on the Mount of Transfiguration, and Jesus had been transfigured before them. There had been a cloud, and God had descended, and God had spoken. Moses and Elijah were there. The disciples, it was overwhelming for the disciples. And then coming back down, Jesus asked the question, why is it written that the Son of Man must suffer and be rejected? And here again, Jesus is trying to expand their thinking about, they expected a political Messiah, a military victorious Messiah. But here Jesus is trying to draw out of them and get them to expand their thinking, to embrace some things that they hadn't thought of before. And then in a more immediate local context, they're in a small group later on in chapter 9, verse 33, and they come to Capernaum. And when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you arguing about on the road? Imagine that. Jesus, the Lord of the universe, asking his disciples, what were you arguing about? Trying to draw out of them what they were arguing about. Jesus asked questions to draw stuff out of us too. Maybe if Jesus was in the lounge room with you right now, he might say, well, what were you arguing about with so-and-so on Thursday when you're on that phone call with them? See, Jesus asked, these aren't questions to condemn. These aren't questions to push people away, because although the disciples didn't answer the question, they were in embarrassed silence. Jesus actually knew what they were arguing about already. And then so he then teaches them about it's not about who's the greatest, but it's about becoming like little children and welcoming people like that. You see, Jesus was interacting with the fine-grained details and events of their lives to help them to become more like him. And so Jesus' questions of you and me aren't going to be like, you know, multiple choice questions. You've got to get all the answers right. Jesus is going to ask questions that draw stuff out of you and draw stuff out of me so that we can begin to get a better picture of who God is, and we can begin to understand what are some of the things that need to shift and change in your life and my life so that we can progress on our journey to becoming more like Jesus. There are many other questions that Jesus asks of disciples, and we don't have time to go through all of them now. And maybe I can post some in our network, and if your home church is meeting today, maybe you can go through some of them. But this section also has some questions that the disciples ask of Jesus. And the first one I want to draw to your attention to is after they've just gone on in chapter 9. Jesus asked them the questions about who do people say he is? And then they got up on the mount where he had been transfigured before them. And then it says, as they were, from verse 9, as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And so that was a question almost like that. They were too afraid to ask Jesus. It was a question they had, but they were too afraid to ask it. But they did ask a question, and they asked him, why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? And that's in response to their experience. They'd just seen Elijah and Moses with Jesus. And so they asked this question, why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? And Jesus replied, to be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him. And in this case, Jesus is talking about John the Baptist, who came in the spirit and power of Elijah. And then he was executed tragically. So here the disciples are asking a question to draw stuff out of Jesus, to draw understanding out of Jesus, to draw explanation out of Jesus, to draw perspective out of Jesus. And just as Jesus was asked them to draw stuff out of them, they are asking questions of Jesus to draw stuff out of him. And then later in chapter 9, they come down from the mountain and they come up on a crowd, and there's a boy who has an evil spirit, and some of the disciples have been trying to cast the spirit out of this boy and the evil spirit out of this boy and haven't been able to do so. And then there's this interaction with Jesus and then the crowd, and Jesus ends up casting the spirit out and restoring the boy to his father. But then at the end of that episode, when they go indoors, there is this amazing question. And in some ways, it might almost be the most important sort of question that a disciple can ask. It's in this in verse 20, chapter 9, verse 28. After Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we drive it out? That's a question that they were trying to draw some further learning, some further insight, some further equipping out of Jesus. And Jesus replied, this kind can come out only by prayer. And you might not think, well, I don't actually come across that situation very much in my life, that there's a boy who's an evil spirit and I can't cast it out. And when am I ever going to ask that question? But think of all of the times that you weren't able to be like Jesus. Jesus, why couldn't I be joyful? Jesus, why couldn't I forgive that person? Jesus, why can't I seem to be able to talk to people about you? Jesus, why, how and why can I pray for people? Jesus, how should I raise my kids? What should I do next? You see, the disciples were people who understood that what Jesus had called them to was to become like him. And when they became aware of the gap between who and what Jesus was doing, who he was and what he was doing, and who they were and what they were doing, they asked Jesus the question, why? to close the gap? That's a powerful development question that I think many of us haven't asked enough. Rather than just sort of writing it off, rather than just sort of saying, oh, well, I don't know why or whatever else, I'm just going to put that to one side. Maybe you and I need to be people who ask God more deliberately, why wasn't I able to? And then be listening to God for the answer, whether that's directly from God or through some teaching series or a Bible passage or in a home church discussion or whatever, but asking the question, why couldn't I or why couldn't we, to draw some more specific and intentional things out of Jesus. We don't have time now, but you just read through chapter 10 and it goes on in there's this back and forth and Jesus asks questions to draw stuff out of people and then disciples ask Jesus questions to draw stuff out of him. But one of the most profound questions, I think, is in that last story of the healing of the second blind man in Mark chapter 10, where Jesus is going into Jericho and he heard that there was a blind man, Bartimaeus, begging beside the road, and he's calling out to Jesus, and the people are trying to shush him and keep him quiet, and Jesus said, no, call him to me. And so Bartimaeus comes to Jesus, and then Jesus asks him this really validating, empowering, you're a real important and significant person question. What do you want me to do for you? I mean, it's obvious to everybody that he was blind, but Jesus took the time and the care and the respect to ask, what actually is it that you want me to do for you? You see, the questions of Jesus are grace-filled. The questions of Jesus, that Jesus asks of people and asks of us, are designed to draw us into his life, to draw us into our future with him. We shouldn't be afraid of and try to avoid the questions that Jesus might be asking. In fact, we should be looking, seeking them out and finding them out and seeing if we can respond to them. And we should also be asking Jesus questions too, to draw out of him the things that we need to close the gap between him and us. So this week, I want you to think about Jesus, and even pray, Jesus, what question are you asking me this week? And then you might also have a particular question that you ask Jesus. Maybe it's as simple as, what's next, Lord? And then waiting to hear his answer. Let's pray. God, I thank you for how Jesus used questions, how Jesus didn't shut down questions, how Jesus asked questions himself of disciples. And Lord, I pray that we would get better at hearing your questions, asking our questions, and having the answers flow between us, so that all of us, Lord, might become more like Jesus, just like the early disciples did. Amen.